You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
they are exercising more, they are developing new nuclear capabilities, and they are also using nuclear rhetoric more in the way they are messaging their defense strategy and defense posture.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg is among those unthrilled by Russia's plans to slightly increase its capacity to reduce Europe to an irradiated hellscape. But do 40 new warheads really make that much difference to anything? My guests Raffaello Pantucci and George Brock will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the end of the career of another senior al-Qaeda figure at the end of an American drone strike. We'll be asking if targeting jihadi leaders is slowing the actual jihad. We'll also ask, not for the first time, whether we have now finally reached endgame in Greece's interminable standoff with its creditors. We'll attempt to separate fact from rumour about recent and future boardroom manoeuvres in the Murdoch Empire, and
we need to stop eating Nutella because of the palm oil in it. It causes considerable problems such as deforestation. They must use alternative raw materials.
We'll find out who won the Nutella war. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University London. Welcome both. Now, first of all tonight, 2015 continues to be quite the special year for Cold War nostalgists. Following NATO's announcement of a build-up of troops in the Baltic states, Russia has responded by promising to add 40 more intercontinental ballistic missiles to its nuclear arsenal this year. Both sides inevitably now accusing each other of dangerous, irresponsible saber-rattling, etc. Raffaello, according to the New START numbers as of March this year, Russia already had 1,582 strategic warheads, variously missile and bomber-ready, etc. 40 more of them. Does it really make any difference to anything?
No, I mean, practically speaking, it doesn't make much of a difference at all. I mean, they've got a huge weaponry already that can frankly eradicate most of the enemies that they're facing off against.
I mean, 1,582 warheads will do, won't it?
I think it'll cover you, you know. Most situations will be covered by that many. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're thinking of interstellar wars that, you know, we haven't really conceptualized yet. But I think the interesting context to look at this particular aspect is within the fact that we saw, I think it was earlier this week or late last week, the United States announced that it was going to start deploying forces in Eastern Europe. And so I think what we're seeing here is this kind of Cold War facing off.
Well, specifically in the Baltic states, which were not, of course, just Soviet satellites. They were actual constituents of the Soviet Union.
Right, exactly. But they're now also member states of the European Union.
Indeed so.
And members of NATO, which is, I think, what changes that dynamic somewhat. But at the same time, I think this is posturing between the two sides, and this is about trying to ratchet these things back up. I think it's actually very interesting to consider sitting here in London when we think about the fact that in the UK, the whole debate has been locked around whether we want a nuclear deterrent anymore. You know, and this whole question of Trident and whether to renew it or not is coming at the same time as you can see one of the major powers that has this huge arsenal of nuclear weapons is in fact ratcheting them up at the same time. So it does become a question of, you know, what kind of a world are we really living in, which is about facing off between different countries, but at the same time where nuclear weapons are still seen as a kind of a chip to potentially play.
George Brock, Raffaello, they're quite correctly saying that there is more than an element of posturing to this. Now, presumably NATO, who aren't, you know, complete idiots, will have factored in some sort of Russian response to their plans to deploy troops to the Baltic states. Might NATO be pleasantly surprised that all Russia's planning to do is, you know, add a 40 strategically irrelevant warheads to its nuclear stockpile?
Well, I don't think the arithmetic is very alarming. I'm sure Raffaello is right about that. But it suits Putin particularly. Let's see it this way. It suits Putin very much to do old-fashioned Cold War, big geostrategic willy-waving. Because what Putin really cares about, the risks of that going wrong, going bad, going nuclear, remain as low as they ever did. Putin would be incredibly stupid I mean, quite incredibly stupid to start a nuclear exchange with the West. He would lose, and his reputation in Russian history for several centuries to come would be the fool who led us to disaster.
There wouldn't be any Russian history for several centuries to come.
Well, indeed, there wouldn't be much of it. There might only be the odd historian left. But his really important project is no democracies on our borders. Mm. That's a much nastier project. He's doing rather better with it. And it's very, very difficult to frustrate. Much harder. Anything which distracts from that project, from his point of view, generally good news.
Rafaela, the worry about this has backed off a little bit about any Russian interference in the Baltic states, but certainly when they started poking and provoking and prodding in Ukraine, all the while denying they were doing it, this was the nightmare scenario cooked up, that they might start stirring things up among Russian-speaking ethnic Russian minorities in Estonia and Latvia in particular. Has that danger receded, and does the deployment of NATO troops to the Baltics make any difference to it?
Well, I actually think that those fears are always a bit overplayed, to be honest, because, I mean, there is a difference in terms of the European and NATO relationship with countries like Ukraine or Georgia before, you know, and the ones that we'll see with the Baltics. I mean, the Baltics are European Union member states. They're NATO member states. This means that there are treaty agreements that frankly lay out quite literally what the West will have to do if, or what the United States, the United Kingdom will have to do if the Russians take some military action against them. So there's kind of a set of protocols in place that means that it seems very difficult for the Russians to actually sort of engage in sort of big warfare in these places, or the sorts of activity we're seeing happening in Ukraine, because they would be crossing a line that they haven't really crossed yet. And it would really be something different that would potentially have ramifications of sort of, you know, global conflict. But at the same time, I think what's very interesting is that, and this is a project we've been working at recently, is trying to look at the sort of the cyber aspects and the information aspects of the Russian push into these parts of the world. And if you look at what they were doing in parts of the Baltics in terms of attacking cyber infrastructure, you know, Estonia is a country that prides itself on being a sort of forefront of e-technology and, you know, being a wired up country. And the Russians have done a very good job of attacking a lot of that infrastructure in very dark sort of ways. And in some ways, the question for me is more about, you know, how is this changing the dynamic of that kind of, where is the lines of conflict really drawn? And that's what's the really interesting aspect of where the Russians are pushing. I think this sort of classic, you know, building big weapons, showing that we have more nukes than you, is a return to an old posturing. But it's actually these other things that are happening that are really interesting.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at a slightly livelier front line, which is Yemen, where the local franchise of Al-Qaeda has announced that it has a new commander, one Qasim al-Raimi. They are being surprisingly insouciant about making his name public, given the fate of his immediate predecessor, Nasser al-Wahaisi, who's been killed by an American drone strike in the Yemeni port of Makalla. Now, the unlamented Mr. al-Wahaisi was far from the first senior jihadi to die in a targeted assault of one kind or another. The jihad, you will all have noticed, appears wearisomely persistent. George Brock, this strategy is rather crassly termed in some quarters the whack-a-mole approach to dealing with the jihad. Do we get the impression it's actually working?
I think it's slowing them down. Bear in mind that most of those fatal strikes, those so-called decapitation strikes, are against al-Qaeda people. And of course, al-Qaeda is suffering against, currently, its very largest threat, which is not drone strikes, but ISIS. Now, whether or not the intelligence exists to attempt a decapitation strike against ISIS leaders, I don't know. But it seems to take other forces quite a long time to get round to doing this. So it could be that actually we're looking at strikes against the wrong target, or not the most important target, put it that way.
Rafaela, what are the assumptions that the people who orchestrate these strikes are making about the nature of al-Qaeda and, I suppose, even ISIS? Because, you know, the US military, for example, would not disband tomorrow if somebody assassinated the chairman of the Joint Chiefs today. The institution still exists, the cause, the force still exists. Is this largely for domestic consumption, saying, look, we got another one?
No, I think it's a bit more than that. I mean, I think that in some ways, you're right. And al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the Yemeni sort of affiliate of al-Qaeda, which Nasser al-Wahaisi was the head of, but he's also the number two of global al-Qaeda, was an interesting organization, or is an interesting organization, because it's actually quite decentralized. And they've managed they've done a very good job of sort of, you know, putting leadership out to sort of regional leaders who are the ones who really control the things. And so when you take out a leader, it doesn't necessarily change the dynamic. But what it does change is that Nasser al-Wehhashi in particular was, you know, there were a lot of tribal connections. And in Yemen, it's not just about being a sort of effective fighting force. It's about developing relationships and developing links with different tribes. And that's what enables you to continue to exist as an organization there. And he had a lot of these relationships tied up within himself. So removing him does change that dynamic a little bit on the ground. On the other side of the equation, you know, this is the Al-Qaeda number two. You know, we took out, you know, or the Americans took out Osama bin Laden a few years back. Ayman al-Zawahiri is hiding somewhere in Waziristan. We don't know where. And now we've got their number two of their global organization taken out. It does have a sort of palliative effect on these organizations to have these senior figures taken out, because it does show that they're not invulnerable and they are actually forces that can be defeated.
George, the answer to this question, I am aware in advance before I ask it, may be clearly both. But do you think the strategies, to the extent that it's beneficial, is it psychological or is it actually strategic?
I literally do think it's both, Andrew. I mean, clearly you have some strategic advantage. People can't think out plans as well. They don't know, the new guy doesn't know as much, may not be, so on and so on. Replacement is always a bit difficult, albeit turnover in these jobs at the top of Al-Qaeda tends to be very fast, so I suppose a lot of people prepare themselves to take the top jobs. But also, of course, it has a psychological intimidating effect. You may not have so many candidates for it next time around.
You would need to word the recruitment advertising fairly carefully, I would think. Raffaello, what assumptions may we derive from the fact that the Americans clearly knew where he was?
Well, I think that they've got good intelligence at the moment. Now, I think that's the only conclusion we can draw. What's interesting is if you go back and look about a year ago, Wehhashi and AQAP put out a video in which it showed him meeting with 100 people in a public place. And this was seen as a huge intelligence failure by the United States and others because, you know, if an individual who's been on the sort of US most wanted list for quite some time with a very substantial bounty on his head and is the leader of the affiliate that sort of people identify as the most dangerous Al-Qaeda affiliate around is able to sort of meet in the desert with 100 of his mates, then that suggests that you haven't got enough agents out there. So I think the fact that they've now managed to get him, I think, is a demonstration that obviously penetration into those networks has gotten much better.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Raffaello Pantucci and George Brock. Coming up next, Greece's ever-dwindling hopes of fending off the bailiffs and musical chairs at News Corp.
As Monocle's editors and correspondents dart from city to city, they get to know the best places to rest their heads, stretch their limbs after a long flight, and kick back with a contact in a hard-to-find cocktail bar. All this information is now available in a new collection of books, Monocle's Travel Guide series, published by Gestalten. Up first, London.
This place won't ever beg for your adoration. It's just not that kind of town. But if you stick around long enough and occasionally give it your undivided attention, the city will eventually reveal what all the fuss is about. Trust us, it's worth the wait.
To celebrate the publication of our London Guide, Monocle Films has produced a cinematic portrait of the city, from wild parks and lofty gardens to culinary discoveries and the best music venues. Our film journeys to our favourite places in the city we call home. London, premiering now in the film section at monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Raffaello Pantucci and George Brock. And let us look now at Greece, which tonight more than ever resembles the guy at the table holding two threes and waiting with crossed fingers for the flop, having gone all in on a pot now, including his jewellery, gold fillings and shoes. Negotiations that would permit the release of 7.2 billion euros in bailout funds appear to have stalled. Greece is now saying this is just in that it will run out of money by the end of the month without a bailout deal. The crunch might at last have come. George, has it?
If it doesn't come this month, Andrew, it's going to come next month. I cannot see how they can sort out all these deadlines. There are 3 months to come in which they have to repay large sums of money. It seems fairly clear that Syriza does not believe that even if it could get one fudge through its own parliament, it is not going to get repeated ones. They just aren't prepared. Syriza's MPs are just not prepared to do what the creditors want. So the crunch is going to arrive at some point between now and July.
Well, we did want to talk about today some of the language now attending it, which I think as endgame approaches is becoming more and more unguarded and or desperate, depending on who is speaking. Alexis Tsipras, Greece's prime minister, has now taken to calling the International Monetary Fund criminals who want to humiliate Greece. Raffaello, is there any particularly good reason why the IMF would want to humiliate Greece?
Well, I think that, you know, this is a, there's a sort of amusing paradox here. On the one hand, you know, he's trying to talk about an institution like it's a person. And by attacking it in this sort of way, you know, what's funny is actually the institution will react like a person because you're ending up talking about people. And so when you're talking about some of these individuals, they will get offended and they will react. And they'll say, well, no, I'm just doing my job and I'm offended that you have the temerity to say that I do blah, blah, blah. You know, and so I think that what's funny here is that it's a sort of bigger problem that you have in international relations, which is that you often look at these problems and say, oh, well, it's about an it's about a country talking to another country. Well, no, actually, at the end of the day, there are people talking to each other. And those people will actually have human reactions to each other and get offended by certain things. And so when you start to shout about the IMF as an evil entity, well, some of those guys at the IMF will think, well, hold on a second, I'm not evil, I'm just doing my job.
Well, Jean-Claude Juncker, obviously not at the IMF, but the European Commission, has accused Tsipras in turn of lying to the Greek people. He had previously likened Greece's present predicament to being akin to a cow on ice, which is an evocative, if not terrifically...
Is that drinkable?
It's an evocative, if not terrifically dignified, visual image. Do you get the sense, though, George, that this is the point at which the language is really going to start becoming increasingly undiplomatic, that really Europe, and I feel like I have said this on about 300 previous occasions, that Europe is now finally, utterly, nakedly, completely sick of having to think about Greece?
Yeah, I think there are several different things going on. I think when people stare down into an abyss, their language disintegrates a bit. But it is also the job of everybody is very focused on what is going on in Greece, and that's quite understandable. But one of the many things which the Greek politicians don't understand is that this is a very big domestic question in Germany as well. Mm. The German guy who called the German politicians clowns...
That would have been the Secretary General of Angela Merkel's party in Bavaria.
Not Angela Merkel's party, but her allied party, but close to the same thing. And, did that because... You know, German banks are massively indebted to Greece. German taxpayers have paid money that has gone to the European Central Bank, which has literally provided hundreds of billions of euros to Greece. And this is a very, very big political question. And German politicians can't afford to just allow, you know, just do the fudge, do the traditional fudge. That's where part of the problem lies. And I think people's language is getting a bit odd because, you've got a lot of other things mixed in. Economics is extremely hard to dramatize, albeit that it's politicians' jobs to distill and simplify and so on. The second thing is we're dealing with the unknowable. If a country falls out of the euro, we are in territory we've never been in before. And people can guess and they can speculate about what's going to happen, all six kinds of chaos, but they don't really know.
But if a country does fall out of the euro, which is obviously a prospect that is growing ever more likely, at this point, and I'll put this to you, Raffaello, surely everybody, given the warning we've now had, has factored in this possibility. In Greece, and we'll get to that shortly, but outside Greece, would it really make all that much difference to really anything at this point if Greece fell out of the euro or indeed even the EU?
I think it would. I think that the ramifications are ones that we really haven't considered in full detail. I mean, if you think about it, if you know that the currency is going to evaporate tomorrow, well, what's going to happen to all those euros? Will suddenly there be a huge exodus of capital from Greece? And what impact will that have on the next day when the country sort of suddenly uses a different currency? On the other hand, I wonder a bit about the precedent that this sets. You know, there's other countries in the EU who've had issues with their own economies and that, you know, Italy is a prime example of this. You know, the Italians sort of got out a lot of scrapes in the past by basically devaluing their currency. Well, if, you know, the option was, you know, that option doesn't exist to them anymore, so Renzi can come in and actually try to force through some reform. Well, if instead the options are that, well, we could actually just dump out of this whole enterprise and start afresh, well, maybe they do that. And so I wonder how that sort of echoes in other contexts. So I actually think that the sort of ramifications of Greece pulling out of the euro, well, yes, they've been talked about a lot. I don't think that they've really been thought about in the sort of detail at a sort of public level. I know, in state banks, I'm sure central banks, people have considered it and laid out all sorts of scenarios. But I think more broadly, there is really something catastrophic that could happen if we're not careful.
Greece's central bank, George, in terms of what it might mean for Greece, has said the exit would be painful, their words. My question, which I'll put to you, is, you know, as opposed to what, though? I mean, what's going on now in Greece is not good, and it has not improved noticeably in the last couple of years.
Everything that happens in the future for Greece will be painful. It's relative degrees of pain. What I think the bank was trying to say, somewhat clumsily, is you think it's bad now, it could get worse. You don't think it could, but it can. That's what I mean by people trying to convince people about things they haven't seen or known yet. They don't know that it could get worse, and they kind of believe that it's been so bad that it can't. But actually, that's not right.
Because I've sensed a bit of this in some of Greece's rhetoric up until now. There is almost, they're almost the guy negotiating with a gun at their own head, making it clear that, you know, that whatever chaos and upheaval is involved would not be contained within Greece. I mean, it's a joke I know I've recited in this spot before, but it's that old gag that, you know, if you owe the bank £10,000, you've got a problem. If you owe the bank £10 billion, the bank's got a problem. Greece is basically that guy in relation to the rest of Europe, isn't he?
Yeah, no, I think clearly they're in that situation. But at the same time, I do think that there is a sort of dynamic that we haven't seen play out yet and that we don't really know how it actually plays out. And I think George is 100% right that, you know, it looks bad now, but you know what? If they pull out of the euro and the ramifications of that, who knows where that sort of ends? And actually, I don't know, you know, this logic that, you know, if you're so in hock to the bank that the bank becomes at risk, that's true and that's a problem, but I think Europe actually would be okay. I think it's really the ramifications for Greece proper that would be catastrophic.
Just one final thought on this, George, before we move on. The Bavarian burger who we mentioned, referring to Greece's politicians somewhat tactlessly as clowns, is he basically the guy who is now just the one who said what everyone else is thinking?
Yes.
No, that was brief.
It's that simple.
Well, on that note of consensus, we will move on now and take a look at the reshuffling of Murdoch's at the world's most influential privately owned media empire. Rupert Murdoch is to step down as chief executive of 21st Century Fox in favour of his son James, and will share a new role as executive co-chairman with another son, Lachlan. But with the dynasty entrenched, what does this mean for the future, especially of Murdoch's newspapers? George, what if it turns out that the sons don't quite share what is clearly, and I think this is clearly a big thing for Rupert Murdoch, a genuine sentimental affection for printed newspapers?
I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that they would share, either of them would share their father, the degree of their father's commitment to newspapers. I mean, that really seems to me very improbable. People at the top of the company have been waiting for years for the opportunity to possibly divest of some of the newspapers. There's a rumor around that something large is going to happen in connection with the company in London. Now, there's a vacancy at the top of the newspaper company News UK. There are rumors in New York that they're going to sell down part of the stake in Sky. And it's not absolutely impossible that they might not, they might, I think this is the least likely that they might sell papers. I think that's not the most likely thing to occur. But something's moving.
Well, there are, as George points out, various rumours doing the rounds about what's being lined up for News UK, which is the British largely newspaper arm. Even some suggestion that Rebecca Brooks is being lined up as chief executive. Would they dare?
I don't see why not. I mean, she's clearly a favourite of Rupert Murdoch, right? And she's clearly quite close to the clan and some of the other sons. So,
and clearly acquitted of all charges.
Well, exactly. She's not on the block for anything, so why not? I mean, I don't know. I must say it's going to be a very interesting dynamic to see what changes now, because I think Murdoch, for all the sort of issues and complications around him, he was clearly a man very invested in newspapers and sort of this idea of the printed press. And, you know, you wonder now what's going to happen when his family sort of take over the enterprise and where it sort of goes from here.
His actual newspapers, by which I mean the ones for which he's best known in this country, specifically the tabloid Sun and the broadsheet The Times, having mixed fortunes. The Sun in print is down 13% year on year, and I'm not really sure how you would go about reversing that at this point. But The Times, and he did lead the way with the paywall, with The Times and the Sunday Times, The Times is now making money after years of not making money. Might Murdoch have actually figured out how to make money with newspapers online?
I think that would be it would be wonderful if what's happened in the Times was a template for something else. He's certainly massively improved the Times' position, and it would be bizarre to sell the Times at this stage that it's doing so relatively well online.
This another
that would be a very odd thing. That would be a very odd thing to do. And please let's note, there have been rumours going back 25 years that he's going to sell the Times, and they were never true before. So be very careful of that rumour. But in general, for publicly quoted companies, you've got to do what you're, to some extent, you've got to take notice of market sentiment and what your shareholders want. And print in your portfolio is not a good thing to have. So the new management is going to say, what's the right amount here? And probably, globally, shrink it.
Final thought on this one, Raffaello. What's your impression of how his UK newspaper arm has recovered in the last 4 years? The 2011 was its low point, I think he would probably agree. That was the phone hacking scandal, you know, Leveson inquiry, him being obliged to turn up before the House of Commons Select Committee with his son in tow and explain himself and get custard pies thrown at him, shaving foam pies rather, thrown at him. Yeah. Has it recovered both commercially and, I guess, its reputation, his newspaper group?
Well, I think commercially you made the very good point that the Times actually isn't doing too badly as far as newspapers go in terms of some of the others. I mean, you look at the tribulations the Telegraph is going through of late, and, you know, the Times hasn't really sort of faced that sort of a thing. And I still think it manages to retain that place as the sort of the newspaper record in this country. In terms of the tabloids that he controls, I'm continually surprised at how they really do still get a lot of traction. Though I think that tabloids haven't quite reinvented themselves in the same way that maybe the broadsheet press has. You know, if you look at sort of, I can see a lot of people are reading sort of the Telegraph, the Times, and the Guardian in their apps. I don't know how many people are reading the Sun in a sort of app in a sort of web.2 way.
Okay, well, finally tonight, a spat between France and Italy over the environmental righteousness of chocolate spread Nutella would appear to have been defused short of armed conflict. French Environment Minister Ségolène Royal has offered 1,000 apologies for suggesting that the French should shun the Italian product due to the deforesting effects of its reliance on palm oil. George Brock, is this France's fastest ever surrender?
Well, they were called, weren't they, at the time of the Iraq War, cheese-eating surrender monkeys. It was certainly a quick turnaround, but it was a very sensible decision. Never, ever try to muddle up what people spread on bread with diplomacy. It's a very, very bad idea. There are, people take their foodstuffs really, really seriously, far more than they do the loan policies of the European Central Bank or whatever. Marmite, Vegemite, can you imagine them taking off? It would be war.
Let's not start on Marmite versus Vegemite because we really only do have a couple of minutes left. And that's a whole evening's worth of debate. And just so we're clear on this, anyone who says it's Marmite is just wrong and insane.
And there we go.
See what I mean?
Exactly. Raffaello, this is not the first time, though, that the French have had a crack at Nutella. They did talk a while ago about a 300% taxing hike on palm oil, which they thought was, unsavory environmentally.
No, I think that this is something the French are clearly trying to attack again. I mean, Nutella is a fantastic product, which, as a half Italian, I must say, is one of the best sort of spreads you're ever going to put in your bread. Put aside your Marmite, Vegemite, whatever. This is the way to take it forward, frankly. We will sort this out
in the car park afterwards.
But I think it's what's funny here is that the real battle, the mistake has been made, is picking a fight with the Italians over food. Because, I remember a few years back when the Finns were talking about taking over the European Food Agency. And Berlusconi, this is one of the few battles he actually really went to the mattresses about in a sort of European context. And he insisted, he said, what have the Finns ever done in food? Us in Italy, we must have this. And I frankly stand by him on that one.
deftly dropped Godfather reference there as well, Raffaello. This is a final thought, George, and trying to leave on a semi-serious one. Is there an argument, because we've seen it in various other places, for trying to punitively tax personally or environmentally unhealthy food?
I'm very wary of unintended consequences in taxing things. It looks appealing. It often doesn't work. People eat alternatives which are worse. In a free market, there's no such thing as no risk with food.
We will leave it there. George Brock and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Raffaello, you're still wrong about Vegemite, and I get the last word because I'm the presenter. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Elena Nikolacheva, and Tamor Haveda-Williams. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Josh Fennett is here with Monocle's International Playlist. He's followed by Daniel Giacopelli with The Entrepreneurs at 1900 Hours. The Daily is at 2200 London time tonight with Emma Nelson and Paul Osborne. This show will be back, also hosted by me, you lucky people, at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.